Hello, everyone. Let's say our opening prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother,
Beloved
Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother, Beloved David,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only King. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Peace. Amen. I'll share my sound this time, and then we'll do a short meditation.
Yeah.
Bible reading this evening is from Genesis chapter 6. I think I'll start with verse 17. And behold, I, even I, do bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, wherein is the breath of life, from under heaven, and everything that is in earth, in the earth shall die. But with thee will I establish my covenant. And thou shalt come into the ark, thou and thy sons, and thy wife, and thy sons' wives with thee. And of from 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. But of the times and the seasons, brethren, ye have no need that I write unto you. For yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night. For when they shall say, peace and safety, then sudden destruction cometh upon them, as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. But ye, brethren, are not in darkness, that that day should overtake you as a thief. Ye are all the children of light and the children of the day. We are not of the night nor of the darkness. Therefore let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober. For they that sleep, sleep in the night, and they that be drunken are drunken in the night. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet the hope of salvation. For God hath not appointed us to wrath, but to obtain salvation by our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with him. Wherefore, comfort yourselves together and edify one another, even as also ye do. And we beseech ye, brethren, to know them which labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake, and be at peace among yourselves. And I have short video from the Messiah about Jesus being educated by a rabbi that I think you'll enjoy. I don't know what's going on here. Oh, there it is.
You have to share screen. Oh,
yeah, I'm having trouble doing it. And then turning the mess. I got to remember to turn the sound on too. Can you see the screen now? It's just a YouTube screen, blank. Can you all see it?
It's just black.
Oh, you can't. I wasn't getting any answer from anybody. So you can see the black screen. That's good. That's where we want to start. Okay, here we go.
These are our sons, Rabbi. It's time to resume their education.
I know James, your cousin, whom you adopted, but who is this?
Jesus Bar Joseph. He's my son.
Everyone here remembers your betrothal. There are other things we also remember. The morning your betrothed, young Mary, came out of the house crying about an angel upsetting the village.
Rabbi, is it not for his father to tell him these things in time?
Where was he born?
Bethlehem.
The city of David. And then you went to Egypt, I understand.
They have good rabbis there, too.
Same old Cleopas. Look at me, Jesus Bar Joseph. Why did the Phoenicians cut the hair of Samson?
Forgive me, Rabbi, but it was not the Phoenicians. It was the Philistines, and they cut his hair to make him weak.
Where is Elisha, who was taken up in the chariot?
It was Elijah who was taken up. Elijah is with the Lord.
Who resides in the Garden of Eden?
No one. There's no one in Eden.
There is no one in Eden writing this and all the deeds of the world down?
Men say it is Enoch, but Eden is empty. Until the Lord says all the world will be Eden again.
Why did the Lord break his covenant with King David?
The Lord does not break his covenants. The throne is there.
Where is the king?
He will come, and his house will last forever.
Will a carpenter build it?
Yes. There's always a carpenter. Even the Lord himself is a carpenter sometimes.
How is the Lord a carpenter? Tell me.
Didn't the Lord himself tell Noah how to build the ark? What kind of wood to use? And how it should be pitched? And wasn't it the Lord who granted the vision of the new temple to prophet Ezekiel with the dimensions of the galleries, the gates, the altar?
Yes, it was.
And when the Lord made the world, wasn't wisdom there like a master craftsman? If wisdom is not the Lord, what is wisdom? And when Cyrus the Persian decreed that we could return to our holy land, the carpenters came home to build the temple, as the Lord said it should be built. And how?
This is a good child. I like this child. School. Tomorrow morning.
There you're muted.
Again, wasn't that fun? You think that the rabbi, well, I love the, this is quite common, I understand, is that they would give them false statements and have them, you know, weasel out of them or explain them incorrectly. Instead, he caught him every time. And the rabbi is not upset. He's happy with the boy. He thinks, wow, that's something else. And I think the Jesus would have had several more stories of using carpenters he already had in mind. That was funny, too. It's funny, the mother always... I said Jesus was the carpenter of the universe. And so I found this very interesting that this comes up in this young Messiah. I guess it's time to watch that again. I haven't watched it in years. And I remember David liking it so much. I think we watched it at one of the Loon Lake retreats or something, did we? Anyone remember? So what does God mean when he says, what's the Bible mean when it says that, let me get the reading correctly. For yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night. So strange, isn't it, to think of using negative imagery like that and casting the great event of the Lord coming into one person's life or the second coming. Either way, it will not be known beforehand. There's a working out of karma that when the ledger is complete, there's an automatic and instantaneous change of state, and the Lord comes like a thief, meaning surprising, in a surprising fashion. But the rest of the reading talks about the people of the night and the people of the day. So in the nighttime of our paying for our karmic debt and our sadhana, however we want to look at it. The day of salvation comes for each individual. And Mother says there is some aspects, and Papa also said that there's some aspect that it happens in the general world too. These are sometimes specific teachings and sometimes applying to the whole world, or at least a whole nationality or a large group of people. But then it goes on to say, ye are the children of light and the children of the day. But ye, brethren, are not in darkness, that that day should overtake you as a thief. Ye are all the children of light and the children of the day. We are not of the night nor of darkness. Does seem to be this winnowing of the congregation of individuals, goats and the sheep and the tares and the wheat and the chaff. People separating those virgins without oil in their lamp and those with. So people who come to this world and want to stay in the light, if they want to move in that direction and they want to attain the salvation or the return, as we think of it, as the return of the soul to God, then first of all, they'll automatically be children of the light. They'll be drawn to light. And the children going away from God, or not even God. God is sending out into the wilderness, sending out into the away from the Garden of Eden and into the world. I think I have always had trouble with the negative interpretation of that. As Mother has explained, she didn't explain it like this exactly, but it's close. She said there are souls going out, and the opposition force, is the energy going out from God and the energy coming back to God. And we are associated with the Krishna, the Christ, the Vishnu side of children of the light, in which we are being preserved in this present state to work out things, but preparing for the day to return and to attain salvation. So philosophically, I'm more than willing to give a lot of credit to people who are not living the life, and but for, as Jesus said, they know not what they do. This is that we can think of it as God's forgiveness, but it is God's reality. And we have to also see all people in the light that is best. You know, if you take somebody who's really happy, as Papa talks about the mudworm, you can take him out of the mud and wash him off, and he's not happy at all, even after that. He's only happy when he's put back into the mud. And these are negative thoughts, negative ideas, but that worm has come to this realm to experience that, and to take him away from that is to undo some desire that was there. So many of the higher teachings that we aspire to, that we are taught, they are talking to the people of the light, meaning people of the day, meaning people returning closer to God, seeing more light, bringing more spiritual light, and being drawn by the threads that occur, that come down and connect to us. But those threads connect to all people, even those people reeling out the the thread from God. He never loses touch with anyone. That thread is there for everyone. And in the travail that causes the turnaround, in the trials that come up, and causes the turnaround, it is that thread which they follow. You know, the Manichaean way of thinking, the people who, and the Zoroastrians are somewhat like this too. There's a god of light and a god of darkness, there's the devil and there's the opposing aspect and there's the negative and there's God, and if God are in eternal battle with each other, and God and Satan in our Christian teachings, and Mother just stands above that in the teachings that she has, and says that no, that's not exactly the same God of the universal God. Some Christians believe that Jesus is only God of this world. And that was typical before. In David's time, when he left to go live with the Philistines, he thought he was leaving God because he was moving geographically. And that's now it's not in the way of thinking now at all. Sure, people want to return to Israel. I'm sure that makes sense for Jews to feel that way. But the idea that God wasn't with them when they were in the diaspora in Babylon or Greece or Rome I don't believe the teaching now, and it's certainly not in the higher Christian teachings that God is only of this world or that he is tied to any geographic location. But there's no doubt that the dual aspect is there for us all to see is clear. And there are people charged with fighting the good fight, and those seemingly charged with causing trouble for those who are embroiled with them. We wouldn't be here on the battlefield if it weren't for things that we have to work out. We can go ahead and say it's our karma if we like. Master have said one time that he wished he'd never taught the concept of karma because people were interpreting everything in terms of that. And the reality of God is much greater than that. And when you meet someone like Yogananda and Jesus, Moses, Krishna and Rama and Papa, you really know that anything is possible. They are clearly the philosopher's stone. That when you get any material close to that philosopher's stone, it turns into gold. It turns into another philosopher's stone. So karma doesn't have the final word. Not in the sense that we can apprehend. We can think we're a terrible person and we have much karma. And we can load ourselves with karma that is imagined. But we simply just do not know. And it doesn't do us any good to know the extent of our karma. Reminds me of the story that I think it was Narayan coming down to the earth and telling a yogi that he had
been meditating. Remember how long he'd been meditating first.
Right, but anyway, he's a yogi who thinks he's close to the end of and he'll attain salvation. But you're right, he's had tremendous stories to tell about his great yogic powers and achievements. And he's told, remind me, Jill, is it 5 more lifetimes or 10 more lifetimes? And he just so upset that he just throws it all down and just leaves the whole path. And then there's a simple person. And he is approached by Narayan also. And he's told that he has, I think, as many leaves as there are on this tree of lifetimes before he attains salvation. And then it dawns on him, oh my gosh, I am that, not that I'm that close, but that it's definitely going to happen. There's a countable number. I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And of course he gets realization immediately. He gets salvation. You know, there's a story that I read or heard. I may have heard this from Swami Sudananda at the ashram. Sri Ram, Papa's grandson, seems to be. My memory is that Papa said that anyone who had even seen him in this lifetime wouldn't come back to the earth. They were through with their physical karma. No longer held. And yet, and we know many people at the ashram were very close with Papa. They lived out a normal life, dealing with all of the karmic things they had to deal with and the body, so that it wasn't something that changed their life on earth. But they were assured that they wouldn't have to come back.
Did you say, Larry, that it was anyone who saw Papa?
Yes, anyone who saw Papa.
I wonder if it works for his successors.
As David would teach too, though, what does it mean to see Papa? Many people have seen Papa within. Or is seeing Papa seeing God in any form and knowing it and attaining the great vision of God? David and I read this wonderful book, and I can't find it, and I don't even remember the name of the book, but we talked about it over the years. He was a man who was born in the 1700s. And died in 1950s. Swami Vishwananda knew him, so I remembered his name at that time when I first met Swami Vishwananda. This yogi passed in Bangalore, and so Swami Vishwananda was from Bangalore. He did know him. And he was a Rajput royal family member. But he lived to be about 185, and his body was so decrepit that he was almost ready to kick the body. And then he met a man, a doctor, who had learned Kaya Kalpa, which is a Ayurvedic technique, but it takes not just anyone can undergo it, because it takes a yogi to even undergo what was necessary. And he asked the yogi if he would let him practice the Kaya Kalpa exercise on him, therapy or whatever you want to call it, treatment, if he would also do the same for him, for the doctor, because he was worried about his own life expectancy. So he, I think it was like 30 days, maybe more like 3 months. So anyway, it was a few months time of this, and the old yogi was just kept in a room and fed, and he lay down and was just kept there for the whole duration. At the end of which, all his teeth grew back in. He looked to be 26 years old, and he was very, very agile, and, ran down to the river and lived for another, I think, I don't remember. I think it was total. He did this Kaya Kalpa twice. So anyway, he lived 70, 80 more years, and then he went through the thing again, and then passed away finally in the 1950s, I believe. But one of the things, now this is a great yogi, great real attainment. And, he had... there's so many interesting stories in that book. One thing he did do is he stood on one leg with his arm in the air under a tree for 28 years. And then he also did what's called Pancha Agni ceremony, which is the local villagers would build four fires all around him, all directions of the compass. And then that's four of them. And Pancha Agni, as Pancha means five, the fifth would be the sun. And he would sit between these four fires around him in the beating sun when the sun would come up. And he would sit there and his skin would get black and actually peel off layers of skin. He'd go home and they would feed him. Next morning, he did that for 12 years. So this was a real yogi. Long story. I think that's a really wonderful, if I can find the book and remember what it was and get a copy, I'll be sure to let everyone know and try to pass it around. But his interest in life, his whole driving interest for all those years was to have the vision of Krishna. And he tells in the book of the stories. Now, the author, of course, has met this yogi, and he's telling these stories to him. So we're hearing it, you know, secondhand. But that he had the vision of Krishna many times. And literally he would just be so ecstatic in his presence that when Krishna would dance away sometimes and just disappear, he would just, could hardly wait until the next time. He lived for that alone. And David and I used to muse on that, thinking, well, it does sound wonderful. There's no doubt. I mean, and it does reflect a very, very high state of consciousness to actually see Krishna, Chaitanya, and have that vision. But it's not it's not the highest state. The highest state is to have no need for anything on the external anything external to the self, anything even on the causal or astral or the astral planes. Full realization is no need for that because Krishna is found within. And his as an example or a way of contrasting that with the life of a great yogi, bound in that sense, bound to this world. This is what Mother taught us about Ramakrishna too, that until he broke through the Divine Mother, he couldn't go beyond that because her image was so beguiling, and it took Todapuri to help him get past that. So are we children of the light of the day? Mother once told us that she had, as disciples, some of the greatest saints and incarnations as her disciples. Living fairly normal lives. You know, Elizabeth Hike, in her book Initiation, she talks about a life in Egypt with a true great master. And that book really does inspire us to believe that Egypt had great, great masters that could match any of the ones that we know of or think we know of. But these things they turn down into disarray and chaos in between lifetimes, and that happened in Egypt quite a few times, where the priests were completely corrupt, and then it was rebuilt and restarted and kicked back up. But she was living at a time of great height and great masters running Egypt. It's not known when, but probably, you know, around the time of the pyramids or after that, but during the time of the pyramids and not before that. That's just surmise, but that looks like that's the case. I don't remember the details anymore, but she was then, she had a sexual affair. She was in a, she was given teachings of the very high nature, and she had to plead with her teacher, her guru, who was her uncle, to give her the higher initiations. And he said, you know, these are not things to fool around with. These will have a huge effect on you. And you have to be ready for it. Do you think you're ready for it? And finally, he was, you know, for whatever reason, but she thought that she had convinced him, but maybe she did convince him that she was ready. And she was a highly advanced soul. And in the course of the story, she meets this man who's from another country. I think they tell you where. And falls in love with him. Well, after she took these initiations and she was in this advanced state, and she was punished for that with being left, you know, contained within a stone for several hundred or maybe 1500 years is what comes to mind right now. Those of you who have read the book, please correct me if you remember the details. It doesn't matter too much. She was kept contained within a stone. Well, she never said sarcophagus, but at any rate, stone. And for a long time, where she could see everything going on, but she couldn't participate. And then she tells the story of, now, in the case of the story, she meets people nowadays. Now, this was in the 30s, 40s, 50s, somewhere in there. She would meet people who remembered her from her days in Egypt. One man said, I remember your father and I remember your uncle and I remember you when you were the Pharaoh's daughter. And she said, yes, I remember you too. Last time we were together, we were homeless and derelict on the streets of Rome and dying on the streets. So these are the kind of stories to scare us all. And some of them might be true. But there is a huge number of possible scenarios of which we are aware of just a tiny slice of what's really there. And we are lucky to be constrained to and to be assured by our teachers of the benefits that we get from being with them and from the teachings they give us. We are really protected by them. It doesn't give us permission to test these limits, and it doesn't give us permission to assume we can do anything like a rich man's son or daughter. Wealth of that kind has its own real severe tests. I think that's why most of us, large proportion of people are in the middle class and the lower classes, and lifetimes with as a king's son or daughter or being a king or a queen are very, very rare, and with good reason. Many people fall, and they fall from a great height. And so Noah also, you know, when God tells me some thing in the Bible, I might bring it up and read from that, but a few times, and that's what I did today driving down here, I just went to Google and asked for a random selection from the King James Version. And that came up with the Bible in Genesis. And then I asked for a New Testament reading. And that came up with 1 Thessalonians. I'm such a terrible student of Christian history. I don't know the Bible that well, but I'm certainly learning some interesting things doing this. I spent the day feeling very much in the mold of being lucky enough to be a child of the light, brought to the light by a great guru. Through no fault or attainment of my own. And whether that's true or not, it is certainly the right attitude to take.
A quote from Rumi that's, we've joined the caravan of people who have turned their faces to the sun.
Very nice. Is that right?
If someone knows the quote better than me, maybe Rebecca. I would love it.
That's a beautiful quote. I was just going to comment that there did seem to be a correlation in the Bible verses that God gave you.
Mm-hmm.
That was surprising in that with Noah and his family, it was God was declaring that destruction that must come, but assuring the salvation for Noah and his family.
Yeah.
And also, and then in Thessalonians, it was again that destruction, that day of the Lord must come, and all that darkness must be wiped out. But that salvation is assured for those children of light. And in Noah's case, it was represented as Noah and his family. But within every individual there, that destruction must come. The ego, all those forces that influence in opposition to God, they must go. But that light is there, and that light is assured. And that light in those individuals, whether it was referred to as the children of light or as represented by Noah and his family being the righteous ones, that they God will, that salvation is assured.
You know, it's also interesting that what goes on here is the great gardener that God is. He has weeds take over the whole garden. And which plant he goes out and selects, well, what is there? Are there any plants who can withstand this? And so you can literally winnow that out until you get to that one strongest plant. And that's what you take and you plant in new soil. The Christians believe that we all come from three sons of Noah, DNA wise. So I've been listening to a geneticist who, is a young earth creationist trying to fit everything into 4,000 years. It's pretty tough. But at the same time, he's trying to show how what I've learned mostly from him is just the arithmetic progression of souls through family members and traceable by DNA. So, and it is interesting to think that the notion that we come from Adam, of course, is difficult. But at any rate, the Christians believe that we can trace, of course, Noah comes from Adam and his sons come from him. But all of the people living today, according to the Christian, the young earth Christians anyway, maybe other Christians too, who have longer notions, that it all goes back to Noah and his three sons. But the main thing about that is a strong, very strong root branch or branch to graft onto the next generation after the flood, because it's been proven. And so this is the genetic lottery that we live in that really is there, that the strong DNA-wise those who survive, you know, are the proof of physically good genes in that sense. Doesn't say anything about the souls that come down to inhabit these bodies, but it is definitely a mythological story that is dealing with how we can be winnowed out, how we can be prepared for that life. And taking just the strongest parts of us to start the next generation, to start the next movement on the earth. Kind of think too, perhaps that in one's last lifetime or series of lifetimes going higher and higher with each lifetime, that it is God's good will to give us sufficiently good health to live long enough to get through childhood, to get through the next phase of life each time and attain some level of righteousness with regard to our karmic patterns from before. I find that children of light and children of day to be very wonderful imagery that comes to mind. As I say, the only thing that Mother adds to the story, and Mother implicitly adds, is that the children of the darkness, who prefer the night, they are ourselves from before, as we are leaving God. And in order to go out from God, we have to be in the dark side. We can't. The light is so attractive and so magnetic that if we really decide to go out, we have to go out in opposition to that.
The thing that I kind of love about that imagery too, though, is that it's just a simple choice of which do we want to be at this point.
Well, I mean, inside the story is there's as to which choice is being made is not clear. It's just simply saying you are that. You are the children of light. But of course, you're right. Those who have chosen to be with Jesus in that example, they are by definition children of the light. That's why they are attracted. Some people are repulsed. Hard to believe.
Well, and we're often repulsed at different points, so.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of it just being, just stay awake till the dawn.
Yeah. We don't need to sleep. Yeah, these books of the Bible, although I've got lots of trouble, I have some trouble with many of them, there's so much really wonderful teachings in it. It's just amazing. It's very different than the Eastern teachings, because the experience in the West, you know, in the Judeo-Christian branch and the Muslim branch too, is very much associated with it. It's very different kind of. I hate to use imagery again, but it does have imagery, and very different kind of way of telling stories. One thing, of course, we all lament is that they insist on taking everything historically and trying to prove it by archaeological digs and stuff. And just missing the point that these are not stories about history, but they include elements from history to make them more realizable and more knowable. So you know that there was George Washington in your stories. And so you, if you're going to weave a story like this, you, I keep going back to the this Little Flowers of St. Francis, because they were written well after his passing. Everyone knows who St. Francis is. And so they make up stories about him. And they're really wonderful because they point to some truth about his character and about the higher teachings. So now, is it clear that the scriptures, the Christian scriptures are in that vein all the time? I don't know. It does seem to have a historical aspect to it. Now the idea that Rama lived and Krishna lived, that I don't think people doubt that, but I don't know that they have the same fixation on the historical truth of it. Now some do. There's some more dogmatic or fundamentalists, however you want to look at it, Hindus who believe that it's important to see all these things and where Krishna lived, where Rama lived, and where all these things took place physically. But it's certainly our world and Papa's teachings and Master's teachings that there's the right way to use these teachings and these scriptures is to see how they give you access to the higher teachings. Excuse me. They have imagery that really can speak to us, and there's so many different stories. There's something for all of us. And one of these things will really, really hit home if you read enough of them and steep yourself in them. You know, many people used to use the Bible, and of course Christians used to believe in astrology too, but they used to use the Bible as ways of settling disputes. They would randomly open the Bible up and read from the first thing that they showed and say, see, I was right. It says right here, and exactly what I was just telling you. Or to give direction on, well, we have to make a big decision here. Who's going to be the next leader? Who's going to do, are we going to do this or that? The turn to the Bible. I'm not so sure that it's a bad thing to teach. We're so focused on rational methods of deciding things. It seems to bear a lot of fruit, so there's nothing wrong with that. But also it doesn't leave a lot of opportunity for God to enter in. Not a leaf stirs that God does not will it. And you know, the Muslims, they teach, sorry, they teach that the force of gravity is not a force independent of God. Gravity is the result of God's will. This moment, not because God had the will that he had thousands of years ago, that gravity would work as certain laws. He doesn't know. In the clear high teachings, they're saying no, everything happens by the will of God.
I'm thinking of something you said once to me that stays. There's only God.
God doesn't see the little sparrow fall. He sees that the little sparrow falls. Mm-hmm. You know, in that respect, isn't it? God.
He is the little sparrow.
He is the little sparrow. I was just thinking the same thing. God in the little sparrow falls.
Well, Mother always told that story because he would say, well, how do you know, how does God know everything going on? It must be a difficult tally sheet to keep track of everything. And how would he? And then Mother says, well, how do we know things? We know things because we experience things, and God is experiencing everything through us.
God is the sparrow, yeah.
And God is certainly the sparrow, yeah. But not a leaf stirs, but God wills it. Yeah. When I was a child, I used to think that the wind came from the trees blowing, fanning the wind. Because it seemed like, you know, it's as good an explanation as any. They all happen at the same time.
David was impressed with that, I remember.
It's a silly notion.
Unusual perspective, that's all. Just an unusual.
Right. It's a solution. It's an explanation to the child, you know.
The engineering
stuff. Right. Pretty mechanical one, isn't it? It's a mechanical explanation. Mm.
Larry, it occurred to me that my father would disagree that you're a terrible historian of Christianity. That he would be
the Bible,
proud
anyway,
of your knowledge of the Bible. He was quite a Bible scholar.
He was, yeah.
And I was wondering about what you said about, I remember David talking about the worm in the mud or some, you know,
I think that's a Papa story, yeah.
But maybe he was just relating Papa's story, but the taking the worm out and making it clean is disrupting its natural habitat. That's where it's meant to be.
Yeah.
And how does that translate to someone? It makes me think of the line, cast not thy pearls before swine. That maybe that's related when it's for a person that you're not, like, they're not ready for these pearls. Mm-hmm. They're not ready for this. But you have mentioned it almost like harm done, because this person is needing to be where they are. But if they're truly facing away from God, and how can that be a need to be in that state?
Well, how come God put us on the earth? Someone did it. Right.
And God made us to face away?
He made us to have this experience. And in order to, if in order to do that, we have to face away. He turns us around and says, look that direction. What can we do?
I was thinking of David talking about watching from the allness of God.
Right.
And seeing the magma flowing or the lava flowing and wondering what that experience would be like to be
that. That's nice. Yeah. That's very nice.
And then becoming that.
Yeah.
And to do that, you'd have to face away from the light, or you'd just be consumed back into it.
Another way of looking at it is Plato's idea of the shadows. We can think of the light being behind us, and we are looking at shadows on the wall. And we have been put in this theater for our own reasons, God's reasons, we really, it's no different. We are co-creators with God. And so we want to see that. I mean, I love David's story, or his explanation is so beautiful, is that he's watching this beautiful movie in one theater. It's Brother, Sun, Sister, Moon, or whatever, you know, something really brilliant and beautiful, full of light and love. And he hears noise next door. The next theater next door is really a lot of noise going on over there. And he goes to the back of the theater, and people are screaming in horror at what's going on there. People are watching it. And he's telling them, don't watch that. Come over here. You should see this one over here. He can't talk. No, they want to watch the end of the movie. They want that experience. And it's, you know, that actually is the thrill ride. There's thrill rides. You know, that, you know, people do very dangerous things to get that adrenaline rush. Make yourself feel alive sometimes. These are all really mysteries. But it is all consistent with the mystery of existence itself. And it is consistent with everything that we know, that this world is full of good and bad and full of ups and downs. And you know, there's no better explanation than duality. From duality springs plurality and infinity. So that's intended. You know,
yes, the mud worm needs to stay in the mud until it's ready to evolve.
In that example, I think so, because it literally couldn't live out its own dharma. And of course, worms, if they're taken out of the ground, don't live very long. They, and if you can't put them back in there, that they'll, in any way that will make their life better. Now, I'm not sure about mudworms. They may just be perfectly happy in mud, but I know worms in the ground, you can't put them back in and have them be successful. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you're really disrupting something's karmic working out. So whole idea is to surrender all of our worries and follow the don't worry, be happy recommendation. It's sometimes hard to do. But there's no doubt that we are being watched and guarded and shepherded through this life. And if we have to endure difficulties, as Papa says, it's all for our own good. Master said this world is God's hobby, but he takes this hobby very seriously. That's such a perfect statement, because it kind of deals with everything. It has a light aspect to it. It's a hobby, but he takes it seriously. Talk to stamp collectors.
Hobbies are what we do for the love of it only.
Yeah, that's why, that's really, isn't that why it's so beautiful of an analogy? Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And then there are those who are angry with God in their position in life. They say, I don't want to be your hobby horse.
Yeah, right. You know,
I don't want.
Right.
They get very angry that this could even be conceived of as a hobby.
Don't right. I'm being manipulated here. Yeah.
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 Yeah. So.
I was thinking that as we travel along, so many perfect teachings we've been given, once in a while, one seeps in a little bit deeper. And for instance, last week, I think after your talk, we are told that what we see outside is a reflection of what's inside of us, everything, right. You know. And so that's kind of a gauge, you know, if we're seeing the negative, mm-hmm. then more sadhana.
I was thinking that same thing just a minute ago, more sadhana. And Papa told Swamiji, rather than, you, no, I don't want you calling me. If you're having questions and doubts and depression, certainly, it means you're not doing enough sadhana or you're not doing it right. You know, it needs more sadhana. Do more Ram Nam. That's a tough thing. The mind wants to have someone to call, and Papa would do that later on, but at that time he was putting Swamiji through a tough test. I think one of the most interesting stories that Mother tells about Papa is the Methodist minister who was there, who had finally taken enough teachings from Papa to realize, I just have to go up to the top of the Manjapati Hill there and stay up there until I get my realization, until I get salvation in the Christian sense. But until something breaks, I've got to do this. And as soon as he goes up there, Papa's sending some of the boys up to tell him to come down, that Papa wants to see him, and Papa wants him to come down. And eventually the minister comes down, and Mother said, Papa, why would you do that to him? He could have gained some benefit that day. He says, and Papa admitted that he did it to test him.
That he was hoping he wouldn't come down.
Implicitly, yeah, he was. He was at least hoping that he would just find a way, but not listening to anything, even Papa. It's just, that's the really hardest test of all. Because we're all told to follow the one sure way of salvation is to follow scrupulously everything the guru tells you to do. But what does Papa say first? Mm-hmm. Learn to know God within. That's the goal, is to find God within. But then he has a bunch of other things he teaches.
I wonder perhaps if it was also his state of mind in coming down, that if his state of mind had been different, and he'd come down in that complete surrender to Papa asking him, that perhaps he would have gotten the same spiritual benefit as not, you know, as staying with the inner guru and being up there.
Right.
And it was because of the way he did it.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to know more details about what actually transpired. Yeah, I agree. But I mean, just in the simple telling of the story or the simple logic of the story, he made a classic mistake. Mm-hmm. But it's the most difficult mistake, most difficult test, because it is the guru himself. The people coming up to tell him this, he trusts them to be telling him Papa's saying this. And the funny thing is, he, in Mother's telling of the story, he didn't come down the first few times. So he, you know, it's a very tough thing. What he's reflecting probably is that he really did want to come down, and he wanted to have some reason to come down. The self, when we get in these circumstances, really wants a way out. And this is the beauty of Mother's story with Papa, is that he didn't give her any quarter. He wouldn't give her a way out. To save face, what does that mean but to save the ego?
And each test is so unique to the person. I remember one time asking Swami Sachidananda about a particular devotee that felt totally directed to do something. And Mother told the devotee, no, do not do it. Mm-hmm. And this devotee decided to follow what was inwardly mm-hmm. was yeah. coming. I told Swamiji about it, and he said the person should have done what the guru said.
Yeah. Let's
so it's very interesting to see, and yet the devotee was very firm that this was an interaction. So, so we can't second guess it, can we? You know,
no.
It's God's test for us, and one situation might bring out one thing, and one another thing.
Yeah, that's a mysterious story. That Swamiji is saying that because I think he had to say that, and we don't know what the truth is. I'm sorry to say, but I mean, because he had the responsibility of educating you, and he had the responsibility for doing this. So he has to stick with his story that he's on. He's not just telling you this because he says it to everybody either.
Which is why that old story of don't tell lies about the truth, the guru tells you. Because what may be right for you is not right for another.
And what's right for you at one point may not be right for you later.
Right.
Well, I mean, we all hear stories of the guru telling one person one thing and another person completely the opposite thing, and they compare notes, and mother always says don't compare notes. This is sometimes this spiritual path really hits you hard, that this is deadly serious. It's no joke, as Papa said.
Evangelization is no joke.
You know, I think of Master too, what he put Mother through, that time when he withdrew the inner connection to him from Mother. And Mother knew it immediately, inwardly. And she... And he told her later, if you had not had that experience, if it had not affected you the way that it did, I would not have seen you again. Now, all on the inner plane. This is, just so clear to me that without that grounding and that love that Mother developed for Yogananda, for Master, without that teachings, all the preparation that he gave to her, she couldn't have done what she did with Papa. Papa couldn't, he wouldn't have found a student strong enough to withstand what she went through. Both were necessary. I can't help but think of Master without just this overwhelming love in my heart for him sometimes. And so much on the heart level, so strongly. And Papa, much more this great love there, but it's much more on the head level. But Mother connected us to Yogananda so strongly on the inner level that we are literally his children too.
When you're saying head, you don't mean mind, right?
True, yeah. Good point. So a very interesting thing is the thing that Swami Satchidananda told me, that men receive the let's see if I can get this right. Yeah, men receive the God's energy at a temple right through their heart. And women receive it through the third eye point. So I was in Dakshineswar at the temple there, for Kali temple, which is a very, very powerful temple. Even as you enter the grounds, you can tell. And I gave, I think, money or maybe some other gift, flowers, to the priest on the left side, so facing. And as I came around to right in front of Mother Kali's statue, a few people kind of were just cleared out as soon as that was directly connected to literally, I was almost walking. I stood there for a minute and then continued. It's so crowded, you kind of have to move on. And I felt this bolt just hit me right in the heart part. And by the way, I was told this by Swamiji, in the South, they want the shirts off men because of this. So men are not allowed to, are told to not wear shirts when they go in the temple. Mm. And then he explained this is why. But I was even wearing a dhoti and still had this just undeniable lightning bolt or whatever you want to call it. Hit me almost like a lightning bolt, an electrical shock. And then the male energy goes out of the body through the third eye, and the female right between the breasts.
It exits, you mean, right? It comes in at third eye and goes out.
That's what I understand anyway, yeah. Mm-hmm. And men have more facility with the third eye than women, and women have more facility for the heart center than men. We all know there's exceptions to these two things, but in general, this is true. Women share everything they have with those they love or those who have a need. And men are much more likely to be able to walk by. Mm-hmm. Not all women do it, but women do it more than men. Yeah, it's so interesting to think of the teachings having an aspect that is also in the body, that the body plays a role in some of these things, Kundalini being the big mystery. How in the world do these things happen? But I think I've told you before that I was with a acupuncturist who gave me just, normally he would put maybe 10 or 15 needles in my back, and this, he was starting a new treatment with me, and he used just 3 in between my fingers. And I just felt, as soon as he did that, this huge wave. Every cell in my body was sweating. Sweat came out of every pore in my body. And I started feeling very nauseous and fainting, just about to faint. He turned around and saw me, and he said, oh, I should have not turned away. I should have, when I placed those, didn't have any idea that it would have that reaction with you. He said, I really feel bad because I should have been watching when I did that, because he would have pulled them out quicker. As soon as he pulled them out, it was gone. What in the world is this all about, this crazy body? How is it tied into spiritual things too? Of course it is.
And it's tied into our minds. That's easy to see, isn't it?
That's what we normally think is only that, isn't it? We don't know that it actually has effects on our chemicals of our body and on our, and in the neurological part of our body. No. Sorry, we're running so late.
Please don't apologize.
Let's say our closing prayer. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
of thy glorious presence
in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet. And surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection. Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence. Are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with thy the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Play some music on our way out here.
I just asked for some prayers for a resident. God knows her name. She's 106. She's about to leave the body.
Sure.
Her 98-year-old sister is on her way from the East Coast to come say goodbye to her. She's very, very precious to us.
This is a little long. You can stay as long as you like. Oh, there it is. Sorry.
Oh, Lord, your beauty. Your face is all I see, and when your eyes are on this child, your grace abounds to me. Sing, oh Lord, oh Lord, your beautiful and your face. Your face is all I see, and when my eyes and when your eyes are on this child, your grace abounds to me. Oh, I want to take your word and shine it all around. First tell me just to live it, Lord. And if I'm doing well, help me to never seek a crown, for my reward is giving glory to you. Oh Lord, you're beautiful. Your face. to me. And I exalt thee, yes. Oh, I exalt thee, yeah. Oh, I exalt thee, oh. Oh, I